I made a horrible mistake. It was this summer, and my dad was in the hospital, and he was getting out of the hospital, and so I was making trips down to Lynchburg by myself. And on one of the trips down to Lynchburg, you know, you have to go down 29 and thus through Lovingston to get to Lynchburg. And on one of those trips, I decided that just before you get to Lovingston to take a right up the driveway. And follow the driveway all the way to the top of the hill to where my granny used to live. And when I got to the top of the hill, I was horrified. It's been about 30 years since she passed, and the house has changed hands a number of times. And the once pristine, whitewashed house was a dump. The paint was all peeling off of it. The deck where my dad and uncles used to sit and swap stories about wrestling or football or whatever else was literally falling down. The flowers and the things that she spent so much time taking care of were stocked with weeds. The yard was grown up. The once glorious garden that sat out there, in that area, there were several junked cars in several different states of disarray, sitting on blocks, doing this, doing that, rusting out. The place where the chickens used to run was just a pile of weeds. The smokehouse where I know they used to cure their meat was gone. And I sat there, and honestly, I wanted to get out the truck, go up to the door, pound on the door to get the owner to come to the door and ask them, what on earth were they thinking? Of course, being in Lovingston and knowing sometimes they shoot first and ask questions later, I decided that was not a good idea. So instead, I backed my truck out, and I haven't gotten an image out of my head yet. How could something that used to be so beautiful get to such a state? We've been talking about this idea of I choose. We've been talking about four basic choices that you have to make. You have to make. You must make. If you're going to live this Christian life. And the videos that I've been showing you, they're a little tongue-in-cheek. They are. They all have some common factors. If you've seen the ones that came in front of it, they all are at the same restaurant. They all have the same waiter. Everybody is ordering from presumably the same menu. And the menu is the point, because menu means it's all about choices. Now, I like to go out to eat. I like to eat in general, but I do like to go out to eat. It's getting rather expensive, so I'm beginning to like it less. But I do like to go out to eat, and I understand that menus are all about choices. And when you get there, you look them over. You do. Even if it's a restaurant that you go to all the time and you know what you're going to order, even when you get there, you still look them over. Just because you're curious. Anything new? Anything different? Anything that might catch my attention and tantalize me to try something new? Ideally, when you order, you get what you want. You order meatloaf, baby carrots, and hash brown casserole, and they don't bring you shrimp. Okay, it doesn't work that way. You get what you want. Oftentimes, you have to settle for what you can afford. You know, you go and you look at the menu, and as you're looking down at the prices, you're like, you know, that doesn't really fit in the budget, but you know, this does. And so even though I like this better than that, I think I'm going to have to order this because I just don't have what it takes to pay. Sometimes you have to settle for what they have. You just have to make do. You know, you ordered it, and sorry, we're all out of that. And so you order something else, and sorry, we're all out of that. And you get there, and the thing that you used to like so much, well, they changed the menu, and that's no longer there. So you just have to make do with what they have. Today we saw a married couple that honestly, you wonder, why are they married? They know it's their anniversary, but they have no idea how long they've been married. They both see their marriage as flat. And they seem okay with that. I love what their dish was filled with. Their dish was filled with regrets, excuses, and unfinished projects. And then to top it all off, they were going to get the low motivation pie because they had not the motivation to do anything about it. And when I hear that description, I only think one word. It's sad. Now, before you tune me off and think, well, I'm not married, so this sermon isn't going to be about me. I can just put it in neutral and coast to the end. This sermon is not about marriage. It's one of the beauties about this I Choose series and about some of the ones we're going to do in the fall is that they do have spiritual applications to them, but you do understand this is about a relationship, and you can apply this to the marriage. You can apply this to how you raise your kids. You can apply this to how you deal with your coworkers. And you can apply it to your spiritual relationship with Jesus. And unfortunately, many of our spiritual relationships with Jesus, they look just like that marriage, don't they? They're just kind of flat. They're about as high as they've ever been, about as low as they ever go. They just kind of flattened out, and we're living on the plateau, and we're just kind of wondering what's the point. I can't remember how long I've been doing this. I got a lot of excuses on why I don't like to do things anymore, and I've got a lot of regrets of things that I probably should have taken advantage of that have just gone by, and I'll never get those opportunities again. But I'm just not sure I have the motivation to take care of it. And you know what? That's what our today's choice is about. Sad, the relationship. So how do I fix this relationship? How do I go about making the right choice so that my relationship isn't just flat, so my relationship isn't just that thing that we do, so that my relationship is something more significant than just there? And that's where these two words come in. The choice is the choice between discipline over neglect. Now, you hear those terms, and we kind of know what they already mean. You get what they mean, but just so we make sure we're all on the same page, discipline means the act of showing control. Oh, there's a word from our choice last week. Remember, last week was about surrender over control. So discipline is the act of showing a controlled form of behavior or a way of working. Neglect, on the other hand, neglect is fail to care for properly, not pay proper attention to, disregard, fail to do something. And when you look at those terms, you can see that they're polar opposites of each other. And after all, one is assertive and one is passive. If I'm going to be disciplined, and that started off with the word act. It's something that I have to do. I have to take action to be disciplined. To be neglectful, I just have to sit back and wait for it to all fall apart. One is positive and one is negative. If I'm a disciplined person, then I usually end up with disciplined results. My conclusions warrant the effort that I put into it. If I am a neglectful person, then I'm always looking for the reasons that it doesn't work out. Always got an excuse. Always something else. If I am a disciplined person, one leads to successful results, and if I'm a neglectful person, one leads to failure. I don't know very many neglectful people that have a lot of things in their column, they say, I finished it. In fact, usually neglectful people have a lot of things that they're doing, but very few things that they're finishing. And you know, God doesn't want us to live that way. That's not the way this is supposed to work. This idea that we're just supposed to bop through our Christian life and it's supposed to be this flat experience, God never wanted that. As a matter of fact, God requested us to live a disciplined life. God requested us to go about being disciplined in the way we approach every aspect of our life. And that's what you need to realize. Discipline is not something that just happens. Discipline is something that you must choose to do. I can't wake up one morning and all of a sudden God's just going to rain discipline down on me. Well, it might be the other kind of discipline. But God isn't going to just rain my spirit into be disciplined. It is a choice that I have to make each and every day that I am going to be disciplined. So to drive this point home, this is going to be a little different style sermon than what we've done in the past few weeks. We're going to look at a lot of neglectful and undisciplined choices. And you see that name lot in quotes because this is not a lot as in many. This is an a lot as in lot as a person. Okay? And I want to warn you about the fill in the blanks. You're looking at these and you're thinking, okay, Barry must have ran out of time and he couldn't actually make fill in the blanks. This is not a sermon that really works well for fill in the blanks. I tried. And finally, like, you know what? I'm making this way more complicated than it needs to be. So we're going to look at some questions. And I gave you some blanks. You know how teachers sometimes give you fill-in-the-blanks? And sometimes they're discussion questions? What I'm hoping in the little blank lines that I gave you this morning, as we're going through this, maybe you'll start writing down some things about your life and the decisions that you're making as far as these things go. And maybe you can ask yourself, why am I so undisciplined and neglectful in these areas? And can I make a better choice in the way I'm doing things? And as we begin to look at Lot's life, we're going to be in Genesis, so that's very easy to find. You can just open your Bible, get to the first chapter and then just keep going right through Genesis. And we're going to be in chapter 13. And we're going to start in Genesis chapter 13, verses 5 through 11, as we meet Mr. Lot. And this is what it says. Now Lot was moving about with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents. But the land could not support them while they stayed together, for their possessions were so great that they were not able to stay together. And quarreling arose between Abram's herds and between Abram's herds and Lot's. The Canaanites and the Perizzites were also living in the land at the same time. So Abram said to Lot, "Let us not have any quarreling between you and me, or between your herds and mine, for we are close relatives. It is not the whole land before you. Let's part company. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left." Lot looked around and saw the whole plain of the Jordan toward Zoar was well watered, like a garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of Jordan and set out toward the east, and the two men parted company. Now, I'm not faulting Lot for choosing the better land. It's a smart decision. I mean, he looked out there and Abram said, "Okay, Lot, you pick. You choose. You decide. I'll let you have first pick of the lot. We're not going to draw straws. We're not going to flip a coin. Lot, you just tell me which way you're going, and whichever way you go, I'm going to go the opposite way." And Lot looked at it, he said, "Okay, this way we have hills and mountains, and this way we have valley and pastures and cities." And Lot said, "Well, I think I'll take the lower land." And this was a good business decision. It was just good business sense. Why would you choose a harder life, right? I mean, if you give me my choice, I'm going to pick the easier life. You know, if I don't have to grow the food to eat to feed the cattle, it's much easier if I just take them out there and let them eat, right? Which teenagers work that way? If you just take them out and let them eat, but you have to go get the food to do the teenage thing, that's just the way that works. And so he evaluated what was being offered to him, and he chose wisely based on what he saw. Lot made a good decision here. And so you're thinking, well, this sounds like Lot's got some discipline. Well, problem is, and unfortunately, this is the last disciplined decision that he ever made. You see, as we begin to follow Lot's life, and once Lot gets to where he can be comfortable, the real Lot comes out. And we get to see Lot's life in a different perspective, especially in verse 12. Abram lived in the land of Canaan, while Lot lived among the cities in the plain, and he pitched his tent near Sodom. Okay, so why is that such a bad decision? Well, you got to realize the land, the plains of Jordan are vast. We're talking a lot of territory. We're not talking about 5 or 6 acres. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of acres of land. These things are vast, and all of them are pretty good spaces. And well, Sodom and her sister city of Gomorrah, well, they were known for a very wicked culture during that time. There was no doubt about it. I mean, we think our culture has gone everywhere. No, these people had patented the idea of what it meant to have a wicked culture. And well, Lot could have easily avoided Sodom and Gomorrah. There was another city that had a better reputation. If he had to have a city, he could have picked Zoar. He could have went over there and he could have pitched his tent near Zoar. But he did not avoid. Instead, it says he went near. And that's important for us to remember, because reading this, you sort of get the feeling that that city is what it was all about. That's the reason he really picked the way that he was going. You see, it says, they also carry Abram's nephew Lot in his possessions, since he was living in Sodom. Now, we're about one chapter in, so Lot is now gone from living near Sodom. Now he's become a resident of Sodom, and eventually Sodom gets attacked, and everybody is carried off into captivity, and Abram's going to come along and rescue Lot. We'll talk about that in a minute, but I want you to see Lot's decision tree. Lot went from looking at to living near, to living in, to being captured by. Wait a minute. Isn't this kind of how sin works? I mean, we go from looking at it, ooh, that looks good, to maybe just touching it. I'm not going to eat it. I'm just going to look at it. I'm just going to admire it. I'm going to get close. I want to get a better look. To eventually we consume it to the point it begins to consume us. See, this is the Lot decision tree. This is the undisciplined, neglectful decision. He could look at the city and say, you know what? I don't need to go near that. You know, if you struggle with things in your life, this is a good little pattern for you to watch. If you struggle with alcohol, don't go near the bar. If you're not near it, it can't happen, right? If you struggle with pornography, get away from the computer. Get away from it. Don't get near it. You struggle with drugs? Don't get near it. And you say, well, that's easier said than done. Understand, I never said it was easy. That's why they call it discipline. If it was easy, we could just let it come down on us. But we have to make some decisions in our life, some choices in our life, that if I know it's something that's going to cause me to struggle, don't get near it. Turn away from it. You know, Jesus was this extreme. What did he say? He said, if your eye offends you, if your eye's going to cause you to sin, pluck it out. If your hand's going to cause you to sin, cut it off. Man, that sounds really extreme. Jesus is making a point. You have to make choices in your life. And those choices sometimes mean that you can't go near it. But Lot didn't follow that choice. So Lot had to make some choices about which way to live in his life. And so Sodom and Gomorrah came up on God's radar, and he said, you know what, we're going to deal with the city. And so he's going to destroy the city. Abraham makes a plea for them not to get the city destroyed. Finally, God says, no, I can't even find any reason at all to save the city. Not one righteous person. So he said, well, how about Lot? Can we at least save Lot? So God's going to send some messengers to Lot. And we're going to pick up Lot's story in Genesis chapter 19. So you can just fast forward just a few pages. And this is the story. The two angels arrived at Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gateway of the city. When he saw them, he got up to meet them and bowed down his face to the ground. My lords, he said, please turn aside to your servant's house. You can wash your feet and spend the night there and then go on your way early in the morning. No, they said, we will spend the night in the square. That doesn't sound like a good idea. But he being Lot, insisted so strongly that they did go with him, and they entered his house. He prepared a meal for them. And he prepared a meal for them, baking bread without yeast, and they ate. So what I need you to see from this section here is Lot is adapted to their culture. Lot's back in the city. Now, we read that phrase that Lot is sitting in the gateway. And a lot of times when we portray this, we get this picture of Lot sitting at a gate. And he's looking off and he's observing the stars and he's just kind of worshiping God. And remember, they couldn't find anybody righteous in Sodom. That term sitting in the gate meant something very specific in biblical times. You know what the gate of the city was? It's where the bars and the gambling and the prostitutes lived. Now, I'm not saying Lot was participating, but he was sitting there. And so he was not where he was supposed to be. And he sees these other people. When he sees them, he says, they don't belong here. Give him a little credit. He's sitting in the gate, and he sees these guys coming. And he says, you know, I don't think you want to be at this gate. Now, here's my question. Why was it okay for Lot to be at the gate, but not okay for God to be at the gate? That's an interesting question. Why is it that Lot was perfectly comfortable at the gate when it was just Lot, but when it came to Lot and the angels, he's like, you know what, we got to find somewhere else to be. We can't stay here. You get what's going on here. Lot's made a negative and neglectful situation worse because he's just kind of hanging out where he's not supposed to be. But the second he sees God, well, it's time for us to go and find something else. Now, he was not warned these men were coming, so he's not there to welcome them. He's just kind of there. And well, he skirts them away from the really bad part of town, the square. That's the area in the middle of the town where all the bad things happen. And he takes them to his house. And he's going to prepare the meal. And I also want you to see something else. He was really quick to get them on their way. How many nights stay did he offer them? One. He said, tell you what, you come to my house, I'll give you a meal, and then will you please just go somewhere else? God wasn't, I mean, Lot wasn't interested in a relationship. He just wanted to kind of do the thing so he could go back to living the neglectful life that he had already put out there for himself. He wasn't interested in being even hospitable. And well, I got a couple questions. Remember back at the beginning in chapter 13? Where are all the flocks and herds now? Remember, Abram and Lot divided because there was too many sheep and too many cows and they were quarreling over the land. And then we went into captivity, and in Genesis chapter 14, verses 16, we find that Abram comes and rescues Lot. And this is what it says. He recovered all the goods and brought back his relative Lot and his possession together with the women and the other people. So now that we see Lot sitting at the gate, where are his possessions? Where are the sheep and the goats and the cows? I mean, Lot's no longer living in a tent. He's living in a house inside of Sodom. He's traded all of those possessions for this life, or maybe he lost all of those possessions for this life. His neglectful life began to, just like the house on the hill, began to deteriorate those things that he had accumulated in his life because he just wasn't paying close attention. Talk about not paying close attention. You notice something else that's missing in that house? Where's his wife? Now, Lot brings these men home, and remember, we're in biblical times. So, biblical times, times have changed. This is not the way it works today, but in biblical times, if the guy brought somebody home to eat, who prepares the meal? The wife. We learn this from Martha. We learn this from Mary. We learn this in the Old Testament with Sarah. All the time, it was the women that were preparing the meals. And who prepares the meal when Lot brings home the angels? Lot's cooking it himself. Where's wife? It sounds like maybe Lot's marriage was as flat as the one in the restaurant, because we don't even know her name. We never even find out who she is. She's just kind of out there somewhere. I guess we could nickname her Salty. That would kind of fit. We'll get to that in a minute. So he's in this house, and he doesn't have his possessions. He doesn't have his wife. And be honest with you, there's just something wrong with this picture, don't you think? I mean, Lot's choices seem to be having a negative impact on Lot's life. Lot's inability to be disciplined and do the things that God asked him to do, to stay away from Sodom and Gomorrah, to not get involved in it, it seems that all of a sudden now Lot has got problems. And you know what? How he solves the problems says an awful lot about how Lot's life really works. I'm in Genesis chapter 19, verses 4 through 8. Before they had gone to bed, all the men from every part of the city of Sodom, both young and old, surrounded the house. They called to Lot, "Where are the men that came with you, that came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we can have sex with them." Lot went outside to meet them and shut the door behind them and said, "No, my friends, don't do this wicked thing. Look, I have two daughters who have never slept with a man. Let me bring them out to you and you can do what you would like with them. But don't do anything to these two men, for they have come under the protection of my roof." Now I know Mom is not home, because this just would not happen. As a matter of fact, if Lot does end up in heaven, you will know which one he is, because he'll be the one that every time he walks by a lady in heaven, she smacks him right on the back of the head. What were you thinking? Oh my goodness. I mean, you just can't believe that anybody could make this up. You get what Lot is doing, because the story reads just like we think it does. The messenger from God are in his house. That means the power of God is in his house. And so the men from the town show up and they're basically asking, exactly, push him out here. We want to rape him. This is the city. This is the culture that Lot had adapted himself to. And we're shaking our heads, but you know what? Our culture is just sometimes crazy. And so Lot, I guess we could give him a little gold star. Okay, no, he doesn't get a gold star. He doesn't get anything, because Lot stands up for the men and says, "You don't want to do this. But I tell you what I'm going to do. I got these two daughters, and they've never known a man, but you can have them." Really? Yeah, we're shaking our head. No, would you ever really think? But this is what Lot's decision-making process brought him to. The only way I can solve my problems is not turn to them and say, "Hey, I can't solve this. God, Now would be a good time to help. Instead, he decides, you know what? I'll sacrifice my daughters for the good of God. That's really what he was saying. But you understand that puts a value on Lot's daughters. That he didn't value them very much. Just like he didn't value his relationship with his wife. Just like he didn't value his relationship with his God. Lot's neglectful wife just seems to be spewing out all of these things that are just wrong. That picture is awful. And you know what the problem is? Is the picture that we see of Lot, you sort of get the opinion that nobody takes this man seriously, because as in chapter 19, as we drop down to verse 14, the angels have told Lot, we're going to destroy the city. Get your family and get them out of the city. Leave. And Lot went to, by the way, the women that he was about to kick out to the men, they were engaged. And so when Lot's trying to gather his family together and get everybody out of Dodge or out of Sodom before it goes boom, he goes to his future son-in-laws, and he says, so Lot went and spoke out to his son-in-laws who were pledged to marry his daughters. I wonder if he told them about the event where he's about to kick them out the house to a bunch of men. He said, hurry, get out of this place, because the Lord is about to destroy the city. But the sons-in-law thought he was joking. Oh, you see the implication here? Lot's undisciplined, neglectful lifestyle means that nobody took his warning seriously. Sometimes I wonder if that's us. We go out to the world and we say Jesus, and we say we got the answer, and then they look at our life and they say, you got to be kidding me, because your life ain't no better than my life. You're as messed up as I am. Why are you out here preaching that I need to come to church? Because you go to church and you got the same issues I got. You're making the same decisions the same way that I make them, so why do you think your life is so much better than mine? They think it's a joke. They think we can't possibly be serious, because if we honestly believed that somebody was going to destroy the world, what do you think we would be doing? Maybe we'd be living a little bit differently in it, right? I mean, if I honestly believe, I mean, we've all been in the area, and we know what happens when the hurricanes are coming, they issue the warnings. What happens to Interstate 64? It's jam-packed because they heed the warnings, but there's always those few. They say, I'm not going to take the warning seriously. They don't believe it. I wonder sometimes if we lived a more disciplined lifestyle, if we had a more disciplined faith, maybe people wouldn't think that we were joking when we tell them, you know what? This Jesus thing, it's real. It really happened just the way it happened 2,000 years ago. And he really does love you. And he really does want to have a relationship with you. Maybe if they saw a relationship in us, it would be a little more believable. So his bad decision-making continues. You would think that maybe he would get over it now. But 15 through 20, this is what it says. With the coming of dawn, the angels urged Lot, saying, hurry, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away when the city is punished. When he hesitated, You're being given a get-out-of-jail-free card, and you're going to hesitate? Well, keep listening. When he hesitated, the men grasped his hands and the hands of his wife and the hands of his two daughters and led them to safety out of the city, for the Lord was merciful to them. As soon as they had brought them out, one of them said, flee for your lives. Don't look back. Don't stop anywhere in the plain. Flee to the mountains or you will be swept away. Okay? Good instructions. But Lot, seriously? But Lot said to them, no, my lords, your servant has found favor in your eyes, and you have shown great kindness to me in sparing my life, but I can't flee to the mountains. This disaster will overtake me, and I'll die. Look, here is a town near enough to run to, and it's small. Let me flee to it. It is very small. It is called Zoar, and there my life will be spared. So you get the picture. You know, the clouds are starting to rumble and the ground is starting to shake and the angels are saying, Lot, don't worry about packing. Get out. Run. As a matter of fact, run and don't look back. Keep going until you get to the mountains and you're to a safe spot. Just go. And Lot's, well, let's negotiate about this go thing. Does it really have to be a mountain? You know, there's a nice small town just around the road here, and they don't have nearly all the problems of Sodom and Gomorrah. Can't we just go there? You get why Lot doesn't want to go to the mountains, don't you? Well, he didn't want to go to the mountains in the first place because that's going to be a hard life. He's going to have to give up all of those conveniences of the city. He's going to have to go out and live and be a mountain man. He's going to be right back where he started. He's going to have to get a little more discipline to survive in that life. And so Lot said, well, you know, I can't have these cities, but can I have this city? Can I just kind of go and live? And so if somebody came to you and gave you an advance warning of destruction, don't you think you'd flee? I mean, it's natural instinct, right? We just go. But Lot hesitated. And as Lot began to hesitate, he's still looking for this easy life. And well, they actually had to pull him from the city and force him to go. Man, you're kidding me. I mean, how ignorant can one person be? Seriously. You had to force the man to leave? You're giving him advanced warning and you're having to push him out the city? Yeah. But you see, that's neglect. I mean, I don't want to take the time to do the things that I'm supposed to do, so I'm just going to do the things that I want to do, and the things I'm supposed to do are going to never get done, and then I'm going to have a bunch of piled up excuses and regrets about the things that I should have accomplished in my life. That's the way neglect works. And the thing is we don't have to really we don't have to work real hard to see how neglect impacted Lot's life. I want you to see it. His wife, verse 26, remember the instruction, don't look back. You get out on the plains, and Lot's wife was so still in love with the city, but Lot's wife looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. She didn't even make it out the plains. She didn't even make it to Zoar. She was so tied up and attached to the city that she couldn't let it go, and as the fire started to fall, she wanted to sit and mourn the loss of her city. And she turned, this says, God turned into a pillar of salt. What about Lot? Well, Zoar didn't work out for him so well. Lot and his two daughters left Zoar and settled in the mountains. For he was afraid to stay in Zoar. He and his two daughters lived in a cave. He spent the rest of his life living in fear. I mean, what if people find out that I'm the one that ran from Sodom and Gomorrah? What if people find out that God spared me but not everybody else? What if people start asking questions about what happened in Sodom and Gomorrah? How am I ever going to explain this to people? What if they decide they want to take revenge on me for Sodom and Gomorrah and they want to execute me? After all, it was a different city, but they were all kin. So Lot became paranoid, and eventually he said, okay, I can't deal with paranoia anymore, so I'm going to go live in the mountains. I'm going to live in a cave. And his daughters, again, this goes under the category of you've got to be kidding me. One day the older daughter said to the younger, our father is old and there is no man around here to give us children, as is the custom all over the earth. Notice that they're comparing themselves to the rest of the earth. Let's get our father to drink wine and then sleep with him and preserve the family line through our father. Where do you think they got that idea from? Yeah, Lot. Lot didn't value them, and so they never learned to value themselves. It was just passed down to the next generation. One neglectful choice to another one, to another one, to another one. Do you get the picture of the difference between living a disciplined life and a neglectful life? Do you get the idea that this is a choice that we have to make? And this is important because God's not going to make the choice for you. He isn't going to look at you and say, you know what? I'm just going to force you to be disciplined. No. He leaves it open to you. It's your choice. I mean, he didn't make Lot choose, did he? Lot could live as neglectful as he wanted all the way to the grave. And he could pass it on to the next generation. He never forces anybody to do anything that they don't want to do. But he has given us a choice. And it's a hard choice. And that choice is that I am going to live my life for Christ. And that means I'm going to have to make some disciplined choices. It's going to probably impact what time I get up in the mornings. It's probably going to impact how I live my life. It's going to impact where I go. It's going to impact what I say. It may impact who I hang out with. It may impact everything in my life. As a matter of fact, I'm guaranteeing you it will impact everything in your life if you choose this path. Jesus tells this story, and you guys know it's one of those parables that I like to go back to, that he gives two paths. One wide, one narrow. One easy to find, easy to travel, one narrow, kind of difficult, kind of complicated. And he says, you know what? You have to choose. You have to pick. Let me just go ahead and tell you how it ends. Cool, Jesus gave us the end of the story. The wide, easy path, Jesus said, ends in destruction, a la Lot. Whereas the narrow, difficult path leads into life through Jesus Christ. The only question you have to ask yourself is, which path are you going to choose today? Are you going to choose the wide and the easy one, or the disciplined, narrow one? I can't choose it for you.